Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Lester Graham. We'll find out what's changed in our nation's prisons, and in light of the recent riot at Michigan's Kinross facility, what's remained the same. But first, what is the state of the Michigan Republican Party, with party infighting, concerns about state House losses, and some GOP candidates simply refusing to endorse or even answer questions about their party's presidential nominee, Donald Trump? And yet, of course, Republicans control pretty much all levers of state government in Michigan. So where does this leave Republicans? Susan Demas is editor of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema is former state Senate Republican leader, now with Public Sector Consultants. Ken, let's start with you. You are a Republican. Are these really serious fissures in the party, or is this just much to do about nothing?
They are serious, but a lot depends on the results of the election 2.5 weeks from now. If you win elections, all is forgiven and all is good. If you lose elections, given the fractures that have occurred and have been in the Republican Party for years now, there's going to be a lot of finger pointing. Because you have Republicans that have not endorsed him or removed their endorsement, been very critical during this election, it's kind of created a political culture in which public opposition to the nominee is acceptable from Republicans. And I think that's got some implications for the 2018 gubernatorial election. It's now acceptable to attack your own nominee, not before the nomination, but after the nomination.
Susan, dangerous for Republicans to be able to basically fight against your own party with 2.5 weeks to go before election day?
Well, this is not a normal election, and there are a number of Republicans from across the spectrum who have grave concerns with Donald Trump for his statements on women, immigrants, Muslims, and they are exercising their conscience to do so. Where that leaves the Republican Party in Michigan and nationally after the election, that's anyone's guess. But there are real fissures, and that has a real impact on down ballot elections.
Right. Of course, in Michigan, we've got the state House up for grabs. Democrats looking to pick up 9 seats in order to take the House over the summer this year. If you had asked folks, probably most people would have said no. Ken, is that a possibility now that the Michigan State House could go to the D's?
They did win 9 seats back, I think, in 2008. Obama was beating McCain by about 17 points. But that shows you the kind of landslide that has to occur for that kind of wave election. I think the more ominous thing for Republicans is really not 2016, it's 2018, because the state Senate is up. There'll be a lot of Senate primaries in addition to House primaries, primary for governor, Secretary of State, Attorney General. Those are conventions, but you'll have a lot of primaries. And one of the issues is going to be, did you support Donald Trump 2 years ago?
And that's what I want to get into, exactly that question, that this suddenly becomes, you know, what did or did you not do in 2016? And you can be darn sure that Democrats are going to hold Republicans and a Bill Schuette, let's say, and other folks like that to what they did in 2016.
I think it's more serious for Republicans in the primary, not the general, in 2018. The ardent Trump supporters are going to be using whether or not you supported Trump 2 years earlier as a litmus test in these primaries.
Susan?
The wild card is that if Trump loses, and if he loses big, how much currency Trump supporters are going to have within the party. You know, certainly you've had strong support from the Republican Party chair here in Michigan, Ron Romney McDaniel. A lot of people believe that there's some political expediency involved in that. But there's nothing like taking a huge loss on the chin to have a political party start to reevaluate. That's not to say that, you know, suddenly you'll see Republicans are not going to be the party of small government and tax cuts. But backing an unsuccessful candidate like Donald Trump may not seem to be as wise in 2018 as it might seem today.
You know, as a Republican, I hope Susan is right. Let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that there's a big loss here in terms of Trump here in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Susan said, well, you know, Republicans can go through this reevaluation process. I hope she's right. My fear is that rather than reevaluating what happened, it'll just be a month after month of serious finger pointing. Even if there's a big Trump loss, I still believe that Trump supporters are going to say he lost because a lot of you Republicans didn't support him.
Susan, last word?
Republicans are going to have to reckon with the fact that in their current configuration, it is very hard for them to win national elections. They just don't have the support of critical groups, African Americans, Latinos, increasingly college-educated voters, and white women. That means that they can be very successful in state house races in Michigan. But if you're trying to build a national party, there are a lot of things that they need to consider and reevaluate. I'm not confident they'll do so, but it may not be smooth sledding in the future in 2020 or 2024 if they don't.
Susan Demas, editor of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, former state Senate Republican leader, now with Public Sector Consultants. As always, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Northern Michigan, Lon Johnson wants your vote. The Democrat is running in Michigan's largest land-wise speaking congressional district. That is the first. It is the entire Upper Peninsula and much of Michigan's upper lower peninsula. Lon joins us now. Lon, where are you calling in from?
I'm calling from Marquette today.
So the lion's share of the attention given to this race right now is who has lived in the district the longest. Is that really, though, the biggest issue facing voters in the first?
I think the biggest issue facing voters is about who's going to protect what they've worked a lifetime for, their Social Security, their Medicare, their VA benefits. It's not about where Jack or I have lived, but however, it is about transparency and truth. Jack Bergman, this spring and summer, went around and told everyone he was a full-time resident of Watersmeet and had been since 2010. The fact is, Jack Bergman retired from the Marine Corps in 2009 in Louisiana and stayed there. Jack Bergman took a four-year appointment from the Louisiana governor. Jack Bergman has sat on a New Orleans school board until August of this year, regularly attending school board meetings until the spring of this year. And he failed to list that on his House ethics report. Every candidate is required to list all their positions that they've held, and Jack Bergman hid that fact on his personal ethics disclosure. Why did he do that? Because he knew it would go against the story he's been telling people that he was a full-time resident of Watersmeet since 2010. And it would go against this notion that he was a straight-talking Marine. Look, that's not straight-talking. It's not even the truth.
Lon, how long have you been a full-time resident of Kalkaska?
Sure. I moved to Kalkaska in 2006. I moved away for two significant periods. One was when I was chairman of the Michigan Democratic Party, and another one was when my wife went to work for President Obama. I'm the fifth generation of my family to live in Kalkaska. I believe telling the truth about where you live is important.
The residents of the UP of Northern Michigan, there is a tendency to be wary of government. So running as a Democrat, how do you walk that line?
This is a large district. You know, we're comfortable living an arm's distance away from government. However, that does not mean that we don't come together when it's the right thing to do. I'm a volunteer firefighter, as a prime example. There are certain things that we can do together when the time is right and when it's the right thing to do, and we do that. What we also feel, though, is our tax dollars shouldn't be shipped off to Wall Street or to some corporation, which will ultimately ship it off to Cayman Islands or God knows where else, anywhere but back to here to the Northern Michigan or to the UP. It's time that we start investing in us. We've got some real problems here. We're 20 years behind on internet and mobile cell phone service. We've got a 47-year-old Sioux lock that needs to be replaced. We've got a 63-year-old pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac. We need a member of Congress that's going to bring those tax dollars here and invest in ourselves to create a place where our families can stay here and succeed.
Republicans, of course, are grappling with their presidential nominee, Donald Trump. But it is fair, certainly, to say that not all Democrats are happy with their nominee, Hillary Clinton. Michigan, of course, voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary in March. Are you fully behind Hillary Clinton?
Without a doubt, this presidential race has been a train wreck. That's probably the politest way to put it. The voters of the first district will make their mind up on the presidential race. What they know, though, is that they'll have greater interaction with their member of Congress. And regardless of who wins the presidential, they're going to need someone who's going to go to Washington and roll up their sleeves and work on a bipartisan basis to get things done, the same way that Bart Stupak did for 18 years. I'm proud to have Bart Stupak's endorsement for that very reason.
Will you be voting for Hillary Clinton?
I'll be voting for our party's nominee.
Lon, you are the former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Fair to say you worked your tail off in 2014 for Democrats. What did 2014, and of course it just being such a big Republican year, teach you about voters in Michigan?
Well, you know, I think you have to be direct and say, this is what I'll do for you. This is my vision for Michigan or the district, and this is how we get there, and this is why I want your vote. You know, I've been going all across this district and talking about two things. One, we have to protect what you've worked a lifetime for, your Social Security, your Medicare, your VA benefits. My opponent wants to slip a middleman in there and allow somebody to make a profit off what you've already earned, what you've already paid for. I just think that's wrong. On the issue of building in northern Michigan and the UP where our families can stay and succeed, we need to invest in us. That means high-speed internet, mobile cell phone service in every community. That means exploring the return of passenger rail service, shutting down this Line 5 pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac, investing in education and make sure that college is affordable. You know, we can do these things, but it takes a member of Congress that believes that we need to invest in and protect our greatest assets, our people, our land, and our Great Lakes.
Lon Johnson, Democrat, running for Michigan's 1st Congressional District. Lon, thanks so much.
Zoe, thank you for having me, and thank you for the listeners for joining us today.
And we will also be speaking with Republican candidate of the 1st Congressional District, Lieutenant General Jack Bergman, on Stateside before Election Day. Still to come, the future of 3D printing. That story and more coming up on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Lester Graham. We've all heard about the amazing things that 3D printing is doing. The University of Michigan School of Medicine manufactured a replacement part for a patient, manufacturers finding new uses almost every day, and artists are finding innovative ways to use the fairly new technology. The Grand Rapids Art Museum will soon hold an exhibition showcasing one of the earliest uses of 3D technology in fashion design. Iris Van Herpen has created cutting-edge designs for Beyoncé, Lady Gaga, and Bjork. Andrew Dent is vice president of Library and Materials Research at Materials Connection. He spoke with Lester Graham about the future of 3D printing technology. Dent will be speaking at the Grand Rapids Art Museum next month about how we make things.
First, how soon before a 3D printer is about as common as a computer or a microwave oven in homes?
That's a good question, Lester. Not quite yet. And I think the reason for that is one main one. And I think it's usability. Everybody knows how to use a microwave, knows how to use a computer, because you simply walk up to it, and it's relatively intuitive. You've got a couple of buttons, but with a computer, you know that you can type a few buttons or use a mouse, and you can get really what you want. And if you mess up, it doesn't matter too much. Also, with a microwave, you know that you can put certain things in. There's sort of a general consensus. I shouldn't put anything metal in there, but I can put in, you know, and I've got to make sure that some of it has water in it. So it's easily understandable. 3D printing is definitely an area which has come out of engineering and has not yet managed to make the jump over to usability that someone such as myself, who maybe doesn't have a lot of experience in 3D printing, I wouldn't be able to use it without messing up badly. I was talking to one of the people who used to work for Hershey when they were developing the 3D chocolate printer, and he said that, you know, it was a wonderful experience to sort of learn how to 3D print chocolate. But he said that he took one of the printers home, and him and his, I think, 14-year-old son, who's had quite an engineering sort of mindset, it was fun. They played around with it, but getting good results from it was challenging, just because you've still got an engineering tool there, one that's used obviously to create a wonderful new things, but you have to have a little bit of willingness to try and fail, to get a little dirty, to mess up a few times before you can get proficient. And every time then you try and use maybe a new material or a new method to create something, then again you've got to learn it. So although the price is definitely right down there at around the price of a laptop, I think you're not going to find as much adoption until it has that ability just to point and click or to press and go.
I am not very well informed about high fashion, but when I was looking up doing research on the Iris van Herpen exhibition, the 3D printed garments I found really interesting, kind of something you might expect to see coming down the catwalk. Sure. Is this just one of these interesting experiments, or is 3D likely to have a major role in something like manufacturing clothing?
Well, I guess the how does one 3D print clothing? One can simply say, well, you do already. It's called knitting. And, you know, knitting is basically the same idea of basically putting layers of material up on top of each other. But certainly Iris van Herpen was the first, and some of her early garments were very, very beautiful, very sculptural. I didn't see them as really quite wearable, though. You know,
right.
It was, as you said, it's great for the catwalk, not really good for the sidewalk. So, but what we have seen, however, is there's been a change in material. So the materials now are, you can get much more flexible materials that you can 3D print. And also, there is hybridization, so that you get the ability to perhaps take a 3D printer and add the output of a 3D printer with the output of a 3D knitter, or maybe with a woven. I've seen some beautiful designs which are simply just, there are labels on top of caps or on top of baseball caps, or are they just add-ons on top of sneakers? Maybe the 3D printer will be the great accessorizer, whereas, you know, you've got basic cut and sew to produce fashion, and then maybe the 3D printing can give you a lovely clasp or a brooch or a shoulder pad or structure where you need it. I wonder what, I think initially we're going to see it as a hybrid, whereas you can use a little bit of 3D printing and add that onto our existing cut and sew processes for making garments. Because at the moment, although, yes, you can make garments, and I've seen a few of the latest ones where they have a lot more drape, there's still nothing like the ease of production and the ease of wear that you get with our regular clothing.
As you mentioned, we're using more materials in these 3D printers than before. I'm wondering what's possible now for different industries, since we're not just limited to this kind of melted plastic thing, that it goes beyond that.
They've 3D printed guns that work. GE has been 3D printing jet engines, so those work. We have recently seen, actually one of my most recent ones was, I saw a cup that looked like a regular ceramic cup that was 3D printed. It was glazed and looked like an everyday sort of cup that you would throw on a potter's wheel. And it was made out of 3D printing. So we've seen ceramics. We've seen glass as well. I've seen 3D printed glass. I've seen coffee-loaded wood particles. I've seen carbon fiber. There are very few materials out there now which you can't in some way 3D print. Sometimes you need a little bit of glue. So in depositing the layer, as you sort of build up that product in three dimensions, you'll often need a plastic or polymer as a way of binding it all together, which can often then be removed by heating or dissolving. So sometimes, you know, with the first time they used metal, what they did was they used metal with a polymer glue. So you'd lay it down, metal particles in a polymer glue, and then you'd heat it up. And in heating up, all of the polymer would get burned off, and the metal itself would consolidate. You'd end up with a solid object. But now the 3D printers are good enough that they have enough power, they can just deposit metal straight down. So there isn't really much you can't print with a 3D printer nowadays.
Yeah, you just mentioned several examples. I know you work with businesses and their use of it with material. What do you think we'll be seeing soon?
Well, we've seen cars. So we've seen houses. The house one was an interesting one because what they're doing is they're taking the idea of concrete, and then instead of mixing it up in a cement mixer and then pouring it out, they mix it up in a machine and then squeeze it out like a toothpaste tube, you're squeezing out a toothpaste, and it cures as it goes round, and you end up with the main structure of a house. So you can 3D print a house. We've also seen, and this one I think is fascinating, is 3D printing always used to be within a box. So the idea of a printer is that you've got this plastic box and you print things. So you're always limited by size. Some of the most recent printers take a printer and instead of encompassing it in a box, put it on a robot. And once you move it outside of the box, you can then print any size you like, to the extent of which I've seen printers that are on robots that can, once they've printed, let's say, the first area of an object, can climb up onto that object, and then as it grows, climb up with it. So you can build potentially unlimited sizes, because you no longer have a box in which it's contained. It can now build and then climb up onto that structure and build again and do again and again. So we're not limited by size anymore.
You're kind of blowing my mind right now.
So I think what's fascinating is one of the main things, we've moved beyond the box, and I think one of the most fascinating things, is the way Iris and Van Herpen came to this, is you are taking the ability to manufacture away from large-scale industry and putting it in the hands of individuals. It's amazing when you see kids at some of these 3D printing shows, and they suddenly realize they can make things. They can make things that normally they would have to go out to a store to buy. So you can try an action figure in three different poses. You can do it in three different colors. You can add on a helmet. You can play with making, but it allows a level of creativity we have not been able to do before. So someone with a 3D printer can start making things and start creating right off the bat, whereas typically you'd have to go to a manufacturer, get a prototype, and then use a large machine to have it made. Now you're having the making ability in regular people's hands, and that is really what's led to the explosion of the industry, is that if you left it in the hands of the engineers, they would have simply iterated. They would have made better quality prototypes. But you put it in the hands of designers and creators like Iris Van Herpen, and who knows where it's going to go. And that, I think, is what's really caused the revolution and what's made it expand so fast.
That is Andrew Dent. He will be appearing at the Grand Rapids Art Museum on November 9th at 7 o'clock to talk about additive manufacturing and the future of how we make things. We've been referencing Iris Van Herpen's Transforming Fashion exhibit. That starts October 23rd and runs through January 15th of 17. Dr. Dent, thanks very much for talking with us about this. This is pretty fascinating stuff.
Thank you, Lester. Good talking to you.
Baby boomers are retiring. While many look forward to spending more time with their spouse in their golden years, others are finding they're facing retirement alone. Sandy Olger is starting that journey. She lost her husband and her mother all in the same year. Lisa Beatty is an attorney with Naraki Center. That firm focuses on seniors. It recently held a seminar on helping women who become single later in life. Whether they're widowed or divorced, they have to adjust to life on their own, socially, financially, and otherwise. Sandy and Lisa recently spoke with Lester Graham.
Sandy, how is being a woman and single now being different than a man and being single when facing retirement years?
Well, I think so often men have a job or a hobby that they do on a regular basis, where women, pretty much your family, taking care of your husband and so forth, is your life. You may work, but when you get home, you've got all that to take care of, and then you don't. It's gone.
I was told that you lost your mother, and then 3 weeks later, you lost your husband. What kind of adjustments in life did you face?
Well, I tried to spend 3 or 4 days a week with my mother and 3 or 4 days a week with my husband. Other people stayed by my mom when I couldn't be there, and I had caregivers for my husband when I wasn't there.
He was ill?
Yes, he was ill. He had dementia, went into Alzheimer's, and toward the end he couldn't swallow or eat or anything. So that was a real hard thing to watch.
So they're both gone. You're alone. Tell me what that's like when you lose two people that have been most of your life, all of your life in your mother's case.
Right. I still, and it's been a little over a year and a half, I still go to the telephone to call Mom. And I'm always going to the grocery store and looking for her favorite things, whether it was baked goods or her particular coffee. Do the same thing for Jerry. There were certain things that he always liked. And, you know, some days I find myself in the grocery store in that aisle, and I just stop and I cry. Mm. Because I'm not going to buy it for myself. It's not something in particular that I would like, but I knew they loved.
So you have to plan for yourself now. You have to plan dealing with retirement issues, estate issues, all those things you have to plan for. That would seem daunting as a couple. Now you've got to make all these decisions on your own. How's that been?
Well, as Lisa and I was talking earlier, you need to find someone you can trust to talk it over with, because you're used to talking to your mother, your father, your spouse, and all at once, none of those people are there to help you. For me, it's always look to my God, pray, and hope the answer comes. And I find it usually does, and in a way that maybe I didn't expect it to come.
Lisa, when a woman is facing retirement alone or planning for their life after losing someone, what's the biggest concerns she might bring to you?
Well, as an attorney, as an elder law attorney, we meet with a lot of widows and widowers who are concerned about their futures. How can they protect themselves financially? How can they protect themselves legally? And those are some of their biggest concerns when they're coming to see me in the office on a more professional level. But our firm was looking to try and find a way that we could provide some benefit to the singles in our community, and we came up with this idea of this Single Women's Guide to Retirement. When I'm presenting that seminar, when we're doing this workshop, one of the things that I hear most is, my spouse has passed away and I have all of this time and I just don't know what to do anymore, because so many spouses are caregiving, and all of a sudden this spouse has passed and they don't know what to do. They don't know where to turn, and they're just overwhelmed with all of the hours in the day.
So this is beyond estate planning. It's beyond preparing for long-term care or whatever they might have in their future. It's about trying to find a way to help them. You're not a social service agency. You're not a social club. You're a law firm. How do you help them? How do you guide them in finding a way to fill those days that used to be filled with the people they love?
Well, as an elder law attorney, I'm certainly working with seniors all day, every day. And so I'm very familiar with and comfortable speaking with people about those challenges. And I hear them on a daily basis. When we provide legal services to a client, my title is attorney and counselor, and I'm doing a lot of counseling. So to create a workshop environment for singles, particularly single women, to come in and talk about these things wasn't a stretch at all as far as what to talk about or how to talk about it. So, yes, I wear the social work hat sometimes, and I wear the lawyer hat sometimes, and sometimes I do both.
Sadie, turning to a law firm might seem like a necessity. I mean, you've got to get your affairs in order after losing people in your life. But I get the feeling this has gone beyond just getting legal guidance for you. What have you learned from this experience, this workshop, the seminars that they're holding,
Like I was saying, you begin to trust somebody, and before long, they're friends. You know, they know everything there is to know because they've been through the grieving with you, and I found them there all the time. I mean, I could call and talk to someone at any time I needed to. And although we started on one situation and then my husband passed, we went into another legal situation, and they helped me through that also.
So I want to ask each of you the same question as we get ready to close here. Tell me your best advice for someone who faces the same situation, maybe it's new to their lives. What can you tell them? What kind of advice would you give them to deal with the loss of a spouse and to get on with their lives in a meaningful way?
Well, first, find someone that you can trust, whether you're your best friend, someone at work, someone at church. Find someone that you can trust, that you can talk with. Always look for someone that can help you figure out, because so often you got to put it in words, and it's hard to do that. You've lost everybody you've been able to trust and work with, and all of a sudden you got to find someone new. And join an organization such as, for me, it was the Alzheimer's. Get out. Be with people. I enjoy children and senior citizens, so the Alzheimer's Walk was a great thing for me because I had both. You know, I had little tots that weren't even able to walk and senior citizen wheelchairs that were just having a great time. And my Aunt Ellen used to always say, if a door closes, look for the window. Mm. Climb through the window. And sometimes that's what you have to do.
Lisa, any advice for people who are facing this situation?
I think it's most important that everybody in this situation, widows, widowers, give yourselves time to grieve. Let that pass. It's okay. When the dust settles, it's really, really important to try and identify what your goals are, financial goals, health goals, goals about where you might want to live, whether you want to work, whether you want to travel, what do you want to do, and try and figure out what's most important to you. And then once you identify those goals, actually set time frames, make them real, and then work towards achieving them. It gives people focus. It gives them a reason to get up in the morning, gives them things to do. Surround yourself with people, like Sandy was saying, that are perhaps in similar circumstances. Create your support group. Find your good advisors, and stick with your plan.
That's Lisa Beatty. She's an attorney with Naraki Center for Elder Law, Special Needs, and Disability Planning. We also heard from Sandy Olger, who is single, retired, having a little bit of fun, and a client of the firm. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Lester Graham. The book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, has been getting lots of attention by the national media. And it's a National Book Award finalist. The author is a University of Michigan professor of history, Heather Ann Thompson. Stateside's Lester Graham recently spoke with Thompson about the project.
So let's start with the story itself. This is about a prison riot and retaliation in a facility in upstate New York. Tell us about the living conditions at the prison and some of the political climate of the time.
So this is an upstate New York prison. It's a maximum security prison. It still exists today. And interestingly, today it looks exactly as it did in 1971, which is just what it looked like in the Depression when it was built, which was archaic, very, very overcrowded, and terrible living conditions. 2,400 men crammed in this facility. Insufficient food for these men, being fed on 63 cents a day, having insufficient sanitary supplies, being treated really barbarically by the medical staff. And essentially, this is a group of men who understand that they are human beings and that they have a right to basic human rights in a prison. And they had also been inspired by the civil rights activism happening outside of prison walls. This is 1971, and very much the walls between prison and the outside were porous in terms of the idea that one could protest for better conditions.
Right, and this is an age of black empowerment. Of the prison population, about how many were African American? And I'm asking that because I wonder how much race was a factor in the events that led up and followed.
Well, there's no question that the prison is majority black and Puerto Rican, but there were many, many white prisoners in Attica as well. And indeed, this whole protest will go down as very much a black power protest, and in key ways it was. But the brutal living conditions were so much in people's minds that it united these guys across racial lines, across barriers of language. There were many Spanish-speaking prisoners in this facility, and many different political points of view. So what's really remarkable is how 1,300 men stand together on those fundamental question of rights, despite differences of race and language and politics.
The prisoners took over the prison, and like a lot of things in history, it started with a fairly minor event, but it was the culmination of all those conditions you talked about. What sparked the riot?
Well, so these guys had for months and months and months been trying to get some remedy through the system, writing letters, sending petitions, and indeed they'd even had a strike. They had sat down in the metal shop of Attica to ask for better wages and, again, better conditions. But this got them very little. And so what happened was, again, as you mentioned, a very insignificant or I should say regular incident of prison management overreacting, clamping down on prisoners, and in this case, locking them in a hallway, not letting them go out to rec one morning after breakfast, failing to tell the guards in charge of these guys that that was going to be the plan. And needless to say, that early morning on September 9th, utter chaos ensues. People are panicked. They feel like they're being trapped, that they're about ready to be descended on and beaten. And so that's where the riot begins. But within an hour, remarkable order has been established out in one of the exercise yards. And an extraordinary experiment in participatory democracy really begins.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, these guys, they moved to D-Yard because they all want to be out in the open, both for their own safety and also for the safety of the guards whom they've taken hostages. They take guards hostage because they understand they need the state to bargain with them and feel pretty strongly that the state will at least protect their own. So they set up this tent city. They have a medical station, a food station. They elect representatives out of each of the cell blocks to come up to this negotiating table to speak for them. They ask for the media to come in because they understand that prisons are places where anything can go wrong because no one from the outside is ever allowed to see. So they invite the media in and they ask for observers, one of whom was Michigan's own Jim Ingram from the Michigan Chronicle. And they want those observers to come in to make sure that negotiations with the state proceed in good faith and to make sure that they are protected as they go on.
So let's get an idea. How long were the prisoners in control of Attica?
So they were there from September 9th in the early morning until the state retakes the prison that same time, early morning on September 13th.
Okay.
So four long days and long nights.
So there are negotiations going on. What kind of negotiations? What were they like between the prisoners and New York government officials?
Well, the primary negotiator for New York was the Commissioner of Corrections, a liberal prison reformer by the name of Russell Oswald. And the negotiations go on between him and, again, the elected negotiators up at the table in D-Yard. And they continue with the observers being the sort of emissaries, going and hearing what the prisoners need, going back, talking to the prison administrators inside of the prison on the outside of the area controlled by the prisoners. And the demands were first unwieldy and some quite unrealistic, but through a process of consensus and much discussion and a pushing on the part of the observers to nail down, very, very clear demands, the demands were about 32 very clear-cut human rights demands ranging from, decent food to the right to practice one's religion to more humane and clear parole rules and so forth. Very, very basic.
So they have a sketch of an agreement. There's going to be a retaking of the prison, and that's when things really get out of hand. Tell me about that.
Well, meanwhile, while these negotiations are going on and people are putting their lives on the line to make sure that this ends peacefully, outside of the prison, every state trooper barrack had sent men to this prison, and so had corrections officers from all around the state had descended on Attica. And while these negotiations are going on for 4 days and long nights, these men are getting no sleep. They are being really fed on a diet of rumor about inmate atrocities going on the inside. This is the FBI who's helping to plant those. And they're passing out weapons. Every imaginable weapon, some state issued, being passed out of the back of trucks with no regard to serial number or who has what weapon, to personal weapons, ammunition outlawed by the Geneva Convention. And these are the men whom on the fifth morning, the governor of New York will send into this prison against the advice of everybody who was there.
A governor who we later elected or was appointed, I should say, vice president of the United States, Nelson Rockefeller. Now, the negotiators and the observers, including James Ingram of the Michigan Chronicle, decided to stay in the prison to observe the retaking of the prison, which was pretty risky. What did they see when you've got these state troopers and these correctional officers who have been, as you say, feeding on rumors for days?
Well, first, let me say for your listeners, just to get a picture of what this was like, before these nearly 600 troopers and corrections officers go into the prison, first, a very, very toxic gas had been dumped over D-Yard. And this was a powder. It clung to people's noses and in their nasal passages, and they were in their throats. And so folks were already debilitated. They were retching and falling to the ground. The gas immobilizes them. And this is when the troopers proceed their physical assault on Attica. Well, meanwhile, the observers who agreed to stay, and it wasn't all of them, but it was some of them, were in the observers' room. So they couldn't see inside of the yard, but they could feel the concussion of the gunfire. They could feel the concussion of the helicopter blades going overhead, dumping the gas. And they could certainly smell. And they were, really sickened by the gas. It was actually seeping through their own door. So they felt very much a part of it, but couldn't see the horror even themselves until later.
At the end, a total of 43 people are dead, including 10 correctional officers. There was an investigation into the prison uprising and the retaliation. What was the result? Why did 43 people die?
Well, it's a complicated story because some of those people actually were killed in the recesses of the prison by some prisoners at a different time. So they're not part of that state body count that we're really talking about right now. On the day of the retaking, law enforcement guns killed 39 men, prisoners and hostages alike, and they also severely wounded, 6 to 7 bullet holes in some cases, 128 other men. So you would imagine that after this, which is literally a carnage, that there will be some accountability, particularly members of law enforcement. Well, the book that I wrote really chronicles why that never happens. Why is it that only prisoners will ever be indicted for their role in the rebellion, but law enforcement never does any time, certainly doesn't even come, has a day in court even. And that is because it turns out that the state of New York at every level of its government and then really beyond New York into the federal government, helps to cover up what happened, actively covers up what happened. And the book, spends 2/3 of the pages on that, both the cover up, but also the prisoner and hostage fight to make sure that their stories were eventually told.
We're talking with Heather Ann Thompson about her book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising in 1971 and Its Legacy. The Attica Uprising took place 45 years ago, but government officials are still keeping many of these documents related to what happened secret. You filed Freedom of Information requests. They came back heavily redacted. You had a hard time getting access to many of the documents. Why are we still having the secrecy surrounding an event that happened 45 years ago?
Well, that's an excellent question. Again, we need to remember that prisons, whether it's Attica in 1971 or whether it's, our own Michigan's Kinross facility today, these are public institutions. And we have, as citizens, a right to know what goes on behind those bars and behind those walls. And we don't. And so at Attica, it was extraordinarily difficult to get any information about what had gone down there in 1971, both because it was a prison, but also because, remember, 39 people have been killed by law enforcement, 128 others shot. And frankly, that's just the beginning. In the days, weeks, and months after the prison is under the control of the state, the prisoners are tortured. I mean, literally tortured. And so there's much to not want to talk about. And the state of New York has been very, very careful from the moment that the tear gas cleared over Attica to today into not releasing the documents. So my book took 13 years to write because it was about trying to figure out who had either the copy or the original of what the state didn't want me to see. That was in terms of the documents, probing what was really going on in that investigation, and frankly, talking to the survivors to make sure that I knew what happened from them.
So what are the lessons yet to be learned from Attica?
Well, so many. I think first and foremost, what I hope the book does is that it reminds us all that those people who are behind bars are not something other. I mean, these are citizens. These are our mothers, our brothers, our sisters, our children. They're human beings. And that while some of them are guilty and some of them perhaps are not, the bottom line is their sentence is to be confined. It is not to be tortured. It is not to be abused. And we have a responsibility, since they have no, no obvious power inside of those institutions, to see what's going on. So I hope it gives us the sense of urgency that we need to know what's happening in our prisons, and that we have a responsibility to make sure that that the people in them are not being abused.
Earlier, you mentioned Kinross Correctional Facility in Michigan. There was a bit of a dust up there. The Department of Corrections says it was not a riot. The Union for the Correctional Officers say it was. But it sounds like the grievances the inmates were making there, while not as many as at Attica, were similar. And I was kind of surprised at reading the two lists of grievances. So what do you make of that? What does that tell us?
Well, I think the links are absolutely direct. One of the things that happens after Attica is that the state of New York tells utter lies about why there had been so much bloodshed there. They basically accuse the prisoners of killing the hostages, which was a blatant lie. And that kind of lore about prisoners really gets cemented over the next 40 years. It leads to mass incarceration, but it also leads to the fact that prisoners today are experiencing worse conditions, which is almost unimaginable when you read my book, worse conditions than they were in 1971. More time behind bars, more solitary confinement, more physical abuse, rotten food. I mean, it's really horrendous. And so on September 9th of this year, prisoners across the country called for work stoppages and protests. And in many, many prisons, I mean, the media is only just now figuring out how many prisoners did, in fact, protest. Kinross was one of those places.
And we should remind everyone, this is the anniversary of the Attica uprising, and that's why that date was chosen.
Exactly. And at Kinross, which is, of course, a prison way far away from where these prisoners actually come from, right? This is way in the UP. It's out of sight, out of mind. We don't know what goes on there. Well, the prisoners were trying to tell us, and eventually the guards were trying to tell us. And I will tell you that the what we do know, letters coming out of Kinross and certainly accounts coming out of there, is that the retribution for those guys having rebelled was very severe as well. Indeed, there's an article in the Free Press about a prisoner that died a few hours after the retaking, and there's an investigation now. So we need to know what's happening, and frankly, we can't assume that it's all okay. Attica shows us that law enforcement and state officials went to extraordinary lengths to make sure we didn't know of the abuses inside. And it took me 13 years to recover them. I hope with Kinross today and Alabama and Ohio and all these other places where prisons are erupting, that we heed Attica's lesson and demand access, demand to know what's happening inside.
Heather Ann Thompson is a history professor at the University of Michigan, author of the book Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, published by Pantheon. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.